All right, well, it is time to begin. It's good to see all of you out tonight for our study, First and Second Kings and Second Chronicles, Preserving a People. We've been working our way through the books of First and Second Kings, and including a lot of material from Second Chronicles, as we see how God is preserving His people, preparing for, or preserving them, hanging on to them, so that through them He can fulfill His promise that He made all the way back in Genesis 3:15 about the son of the woman who would defeat the son of Satan, or defeat Satan himself, and to the promise that He made to Abraham, the promise that He made to David. He's working all that out through the nation of Israel. He's using them for that purpose. And so we've been working through that. I hope it's been a good study for you so far. I've enjoyed teaching with Mitch so far. And I got to looking, Mitch. How did you end up with only one more class? How did that work out?
Because we're headed to Florida, so.
Oh, so you're just going to skip out on me. I thought you should teach the rest of the class till you go on vacation.
I did a lot early on in the
quarter. Okay. All right.
Somebody speaking in Chinese up there.
Who, the teacher?
No, I'm not.
Okay, yeah. All right, well, how's everybody doing? Good week so far?
Yeah.
Kind of rainy, dreary, but at least it hasn't been 25 degrees, right?
Well, and no tornado. This is that anniversary that coming up in a few days.
So, yeah, no tornadoes and relatively warm, but and rainy. We needed the rain anyway, so that's good. Good. Well, I hope you're going to have a good week. This class tonight is one of those where I'm kind of wrestling with where to go with this thing, and I'm going to kind of step back a little bit and not to tread on Mitch's toes, but there are a couple things I didn't get to bring up at the end of class last week that I want to touch on tonight to kind of bring us back to the ranch, do the meanwhile back to the ranch thing, because we're going to be going back to Judah and the southern kingdoms of Judah, of Jotham and Ahaz, who were reigning at the same time of all of those kings that Mitch was talking about on Sunday morning. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that to lead into our class tonight on Jotham. We're done. You ever been in a situation where you were dealing with someone and you were trying to work with them, maybe trying to teach them, maybe trying to help them, and you just reach the point where you're fed up, you've had it, and you say, we're done. This isn't going anywhere. This isn't going to be successful. Nothing's going to be accomplished here. All of that energy and time that I poured into it is a sunk cost. Now, the problem with sunk cost is there's a fallacy that goes along with that makes it hard to say we're done and mean it. Do you know what sunk cost fallacy is?
The notion that you've spent so much money on it, you might as well spend a little bit more.
All right, yes, exactly. You spent so much money on it. That's exactly right, Matt. You spend so much money on this thing that you can't turn loose of it, so you'll spend more trying to preserve it, even though sunk cost means all that original investment is gone. It's lost. It's not going to be recovered. But we still can't turn loose of it. Well, you know, imagine that's how hard that is with some kind of investment in something material, like in a bank account or something like that. But apply that to people and to persons. And all of a sudden we find out it's much harder to do with a person than with an investment in a material thing. But we keep thinking, because we keep thinking. We keep thinking, something will change. What, you know, one more, I'll give it one more try, one more effort, say one more thing, spend one more bit of time with that person, and there'll be something that'll turn and they'll give us the hope to make it worth the investment. Well, as we wind down, as Hosea winds down his prophecy to Israel, and Hosea was living and writing to the northern kingdom during the time frame that Mitch was talking about on Sunday, and beyond that also, or to the end of that time, and covering the time frame going all the way into the fall of the nation itself, because there are things that he says in his book that connect to the fall of Israel. And so what he says in there basically is God finally reached a we're done moment with Israel. And Mitch talked about that, so we're not going to go really over that a lot, but I want you to look at Hosea chapter 13. Hosea chapter 13 and verses 14 through 16. I want to read the text, and I'll put it on the screen
there for you, but
if you would look at it in the scripture itself or in the Bible, I want you to see this. This is where Hosea is winding down basically to the end of his book. Chapter 14 does extend a last bit of hope, but it's more just an offer of repentance, of forgiveness if they will repent. But verses 14 through 16 in Hosea 13 are just basically his, we're done, I've had it, moment. And verse 14, somebody read verse 14 for us.
I will ransom them from the power of the grave. I will redeem them from death.
All right, stop. What version are you reading?
New King James.
All right, I'm not reading it. I don't like the way the New King James says it. I don't think it gets it wrong. Reading from the New American Standard. That reads it as if he's going to do it. This reads it as, should I do this? Verse 14. Shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol? Shall I redeem them from death? O death, where are your thorns? O Sheol, where is your sting? Compassion will be hidden from my sight. So he's saying, I'm done. I will not have compassion. Now, Paul takes this passage in 1 Corinthians 15 and refers to the hope that we have in Jesus Christ. But here in the text that he's bringing it from, God has said, I'm done. I've had it. And then verses 15 through 16 describes that though he, speaking of Israel, flourishes among the reeds, and east wind, that's the wind coming across the deserts, the Arabian desert. And east wind will come, the wind of the Lord coming up from the wilderness, and his fountain will come dry, the spring will be dried up, it will plunder his treasury of every precious article. And then verse 16 is just awful. Samaria will be held guilty, for she has rebelled against her God. They will fall by the sword, their little ones will be dashed in pieces, and their pregnant women will be ripped open. God had had it with Israel. And they were going to fall and fall hard. Remember you're discussing Menachem, or Menahem, Menachem, I think is how the Jews pronounce it. In 2 Kings 15, 16, what did he do in one of the cities that he captured? You better remember, this was one of the rebellious kings of Israel.
He cut up the
pregnant women. So the king of Israel did this to another people, another city. God said, this is going to happen to you. This is what's going to happen to you. And so God had it. He was done with them. They had gone so far that he was just beyond the point of accepting anything but absolute repentance and rescuing only those who would be faithful to him. And even that's not the case, and when a whole nation falls, everybody suffers. 209 years he worked with them, trying to bring them back to him, to preserve their faith in him, and get them to turn their hearts to him. They wouldn't listen. They became evil, murderous people. Hosea lived this life for them with his unfaithful spouse and preached all the way up to the end. If you turn back to the beginning of Hosea, Hosea chapter 1, Hosea preaches, he says, the word of the Lord, which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now, he prophesies long after Jeroboam's gone, but the kings that are in the north in Israel aren't even worth mentioning, but he's going to prophesy all the way through to the end of the nation of Israel, which tells you something. Think about this from this standpoint. He has those three children. And I think it was Matt I was talking to, about the names of the children, or somebody. The names of the children, there are Jezreel, which means scattered. God's going to scatter them. Lo Ruhamah, which means no mercy or compassion. God's not going to have compassion on them anymore. And then Lo Ammi, which is not mine, not my people. And so he's taking that, is using those names as an illustration of his relationship now to the people of Israel. Here's the sad thing about this. Who would have been carried off or killed in the upcoming fall of Israel?
Those children.
When you read this, I think sometimes we can step back and we just kind of become clinical, look at it from 30,000 feet. We're off over here. We're not involved in it. And the heartache of this does not touch us. The heartache of what happens when people choose to sin and the problems that it creates. A couple of passages I thought were pretty interesting. Around 775 BC, we're told that God did not say he would blot them out. Turn back over to 2 Kings 14. 16th chapter 14 and in verse 27, we read this. This is when he established Jeroboam as the savior or a rescuer of the nation. He says, verse 27, the Lord did not say that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. And so here they were, even though they were still continuing in the sin of Jeroboam the first, who was some 200 years earlier, they were still participating in that sin, but God was not ready to wipe them out. He had not said, I'm done yet. He wasn't ready for that. But then just a few years later, about 50 years later or less, they're about 52 years, 50 years or so, we're told this in chapter 17 and verse 20. 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 20. And this is the passage Mitch was talking about, and we went in a different direction, so I didn't get a chance to get into this on Sunday. Notice the change here. The Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel and afflicted them and gave them into the hand of plunderers until he had cast them out of his sight. What a change. Finally, God had said, got to the point where he had had it with them, and they were going to be cast off. He was not going to just rescue them anymore. And, you know, there are a lot of lessons. We've been trying to touch on those, and we'll get to that again toward the end of class tonight. Now, despite Judah's sin, Judah wasn't a whole lot better, but they had not reached the point yet where God was ready to say for them that we're done. In part, it was due to some restoration kings. Remember, we've had several restoration kings so far. Solomon introduced idolatry. His son Rehoboam continued it. Rehoboam's son Abijam continued it. And then after his death, we had the first restoration king. Anybody remember his name? It's a very short name. Asa, all right. Asa was the first restoration king. He did really good up until the very end of his life, and he turned his back on God and got in trouble for that. But then his son Jehoshaphat was a true restoration king, because what did he do all the days of his life? Even when he did wrong and was corrected, how did he react to that?
He owned it. He took the chastisement and he acknowledged that he was wrong.
He acknowledged that he was wrong and changed. Especially the last one it talks about, and I forget the exact passage, the last one it talks about, he comes to a prophet, he goes and he's dealing with Ahaziah, the son of Jehu, or the son of Ahab, and God sends a prophet to him, and the prophet rebukes him for that. And instead of doing something to the prophet, he immediately starts a process of reaffirming judges and sending out teachers and working to rescue more people, bringing more people back to Jerusalem and back to Jehovah. So instead of getting mad because God had the audacity to call him out on it, he changed himself, he corrected, and he proceeded trying to do the right thing. So then Uzziah was another one, and Jotham tonight that we're going to talk about. So those are your four, then Joash. So you got five restoration kings so far: Asa, Jehoshaphat, Joash, Uzziah, and Jotham. We're going to talk about Uzziah a couple weeks ago, and we're going to talk about Jotham tonight. Israel was in its final days because its kings didn't depart from the sins of Jeroboam. Take a screenshot of that, or better yet, just go through and read through 1 and 2 Kings and mark out every time it says they did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam. Out of 20 kings, some lasting all of a few days and some lasting 50 years, 40-something years or more. Out of those, 16 of them, including Jeroboam the first, who introduced the sin of the idolatry, it is said that they did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, that he made Israel sin. Do you think, when you see this show up, when you see the same sentence, the same statement show up time after time after time in a text, what should that be telling you?
This is important.
This is important, why? Especially when it's saying they didn't do this. And then when it comes to the end, because that they're being destroyed because they didn't depart from the sins of Jeroboam. It's important it's important to God. It's serious business to God when he has people who continually will not do what he says. God does not put up with that. He puts up with it for a long time. He's a lot more patient than we would be. I mean, I'm glad that God's the judge and not me. You know, because I'd be, you know, of course me, I'm good. All the rest of you guys, y'all are in trouble. No. I mean, that's the mindset that we'd have. And so it's good that God is that way. Because he puts up with us for a long time before he finally says, we're done.
Yeah. I haven't read all these, but my assumption is the sin that God cared most about was the fact that they had idolatry. That was the sin that led them away. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of things that all of them did, but the one that was by far was the sin that took them away from God. That's the one.
Yeah. And that was it. And in this case, this sin here, now, Ahab was special, kind of a special case, because what did he bring in? He brought in the worship of a false god, Baal. These idols were supposed to represent whom?
Jehovah.
They were God that brought you, your gods that brought you out of Egypt.
Yeah.
And we can see that today where people, yeah, we worship God. Maybe it's not really like this in the Bible 100%, but it's okay because we're worshiping God, you know, out of our heart. And we love God, and God knows that we love him, so this is okay. Well, this is a prime example of how it's not okay to worship God in a way that he doesn't want to be worshiped.
Gerald, and then...
I'm going to be careful how I say this. I'm not going to say that God tolerates other sins, but the one thing that God will not tolerate is not putting him first and following him and worshiping him, period. And if you're not going to, if you don't do that, then I mean, it's all on.
And that's where we'll get into this more to end the class a little bit about the struggle we have in the 21st century is, okay, where, you know, how do we work that out for us in our daily lives? And we'll get back to it. Good. All right.
Well, it's a danger. We see this time of year. People say, well, I just want to add to, I love God and I want to add to the worship. And they add these, all these different things we see going on in society. And so I just want to add to it, you know. Well, the Bible warns us not to add to his word or take away from his word. And God's spirit, we're supposed to worship him in spirit and truth. And it's all we can do just to do the right thing, let alone add to it, you know, with all of our effort to glorify him. Why add to this? And when you're doing it, you're going away from what he commanded. You know, he wants specific worship. And he's not. And Jesus says, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. Stay with it.
Yeah, it's the question of, can you be sincerity, the issue of sincerity versus doing, versus just doing it what's right, doing what's right no matter what.
Also, we see from this that we're not held accountable for another person's sin. However, if we do sin, the consequences of our sin and how it can affect and lead other people away can be very far-reaching. We see for generations after Jeroboam, they were held accountable for a sin he introduced because they participated in it, and then they sinned as well. But sometimes we think about when we sin, it only affects us. But it has severe consequences. It's a ripple effect on a lot of people around you.
Absolutely. Excellent point, which it kind of gets us to this meanwhile back at the ranch of Judah under Jotham, because even though Judah under Jotham is still kind of in that bubble of prosperity that Jeroboam had brought, and Uzziah as well in the north had brought, so you had a period of very, very powerful time of growth for Judah and Jerusalem under Jeroboam. Assyria was kind of weak. Syria, the nation of Syria, had been strong for a while, but then they were weak as well. And so you had the description of the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel as expanding their borders, kind of almost back to where they had been originally under David and Solomon. It was a very prosperous time. And especially if you read through Hosea, you read about the prosperity, their summer houses, their winter houses, and their ivory palaces, and all of the wealth that they have. And their hearts are corrupt, despite that. But their sin in the north, even when you had a good king like Uzziah and Jotham in the south, there was spillover. There was an impact on them, or an impact on them as well. So under Jotham and Jeroboam, Jotham and Judah, there's still some struggle that they're having there with that sin and the effect it has on them. Now, we've talked about Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, so far, has been really the first true restoration king because he stayed faithful to the end. And when it was like David, when he was corrected by God, he accepted it and changed, which is crucial. Jotham seems to be that way, and that he held firmly to the end. Though the way his life kind of ended is kind of murky, and we'll see that as we go through the study tonight. Any other questions, comments before we get into Jotham himself? Jotham's one of those guys that you just know all about him, right? In fact, you know exactly how many passages talk. No, I'm getting. It's like Ian said the other night. Who? All right, so we're going to talk about Jotham. All right, first time you read about Jotham is in 2 Kings, and you start talking about him in chapter 15. Go back to 2 Kings 15, and because it's bouncing back and forth in the text. It bounces back to the north and back to the south, and so it'll leap forward in time, then it'll come back, and then it'll leap forward in time, then it'll come back. So you have it mentioned a couple of times in verse 23. It says, in the 50th year of Azariah, or Uzziah, talks about Pekahiah becomes king, and there's one of those passages, he did get evil on the side of God, and he's reigning over that. And then you go down to verse 32, says, in the second year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, became king. And so you find this, but you go back actually a little bit earlier to Uzziah, and you have Uzziah, and at the first part of chapter 15, he reigns, and he's reigning for a long time, and it says almost nothing about him in Kings, except that he got leprosy and was put in a separate house, and his son Jotham was placed over the throne. That's back in verse 4. And see, you see why it's so hard jumping back and forth trying to keep up with it. Well, Jotham, give you an idea, let's go back to our chart here. Jotham becomes king around 750 because his dad Uzziah, who had been reigning for a long time, got too big for his britches, as we say in Texas, and decided that he was as good as any priest and could walk into the holy place and burn incense on the altar of the altar of incense inside the temple. And of course God gave him leprosy immediately. Popped out on his forehead, very observable, and so he had to go live in isolation as a result of that. So Jotham took over. So he reigns for quite a while there, even though Uzziah is still alive. In fact, it's interesting, you read Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 6 says that something happened in the year that Uzziah died. So we know Uzziah probably at least saw the Lord here about 739, 740 BC, because it's in the year that Uzziah died. But Jotham had already been ruling for quite some time. Yes?
Question, why do you suppose these kings, like him, why do they want to go do the priest's job? I mean, these kings probably had people feed them, they had people clothe them, they had people do everything in the world for them, yet, you know, starting with Saul, they wanted to go act like a priest. It's like, you have servants on top of servants on top of servants. I don't know.
That's a good question. You get an answer for
it. No, it's just like, why? Like, why? I mean, you
know. It's because God separated the chief. There was a king, and the priests were the religious leaders, so I think they wanted to do it all.
I think that's a really good answer right there.
Moses did it all in the beginning.
Moses did it all, yeah. So he was unique. Ian and then Mallory.
I was just gonna say, I think in other cultures the king was also, and even we see in more like modern times, the king was the head. Like over in England, the king was the head of the Church of England. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted all the power. So other cultures were. You were the king, you were also in charge of the religion, whatever religion that happened to be. Like, I mean, even Jezebel was the one that brought Baal, and she was the queen, so I feel like that's the connection there. They wanted a king to be like all the other nations, so they got a king. Well, then the king's like, well, we're going to be like the nations, so I'm going to be a priest.
Yeah, and which ties into what she said, Ian and then Mike.
So, to put a real-world perspective on this, let's say that you're at work, and you need to go, so I'm trying to think of a job. let's say you need to go get your car fixed, and you're somewhat competent in getting your car fixed, but you're, you know, you're gonna take it in this time, and the technician starts working on it, but you don't agree with how the technician does things, and you think, if I was working on my car, I would get this, because it starts taking a little longer than you thought it would take. And now all of a sudden you're like, if I was doing this, I'd be done, my car would be fixed, and I'm on the road ready to go. This guy has no idea what he's doing. And some people would probably start getting a bit snippy. So to relate this back, perhaps Isaiah just simply thought, I can do a better job because I'm great at everything I do.
Could be.
Well, Mallory hit the nail on the head at the end, but Merlin's prophet, priest, and king, right?
Mm-hmm.
And each one kind of wants to be all that. And really the only one that is all that's Christ, prophet, priest, and king. And like I said, they're kind of greedy. They want that all inclusion. And Christ is that inclusion of that. And they're not worried about the sincerity of it, in a sense. Don't worry about if God's upset at it. They're worried about, let's get this done. I want to do this.
Yeah, it becomes about pride and about self.
It's like, I'm not an elder. I'm not qualified to be an elder. You know, and by that, I'm not qualified to make those decisions. So why would I try to usurp them? Well, then God would be offended by that.
Mm-hmm. All right, good points. All right, good comments. Anybody else? All right. So getting back to the chart here, you can see that there's overlap with this, and there's an interesting thing here that goes on, and we'll look at, and I don't know that I have that much answer for it, but it seems like here, that right about in here, Jotham is deposed by Ahaz, even though he doesn't, lives for a few more years, because you have in Isaiah chapter 7, you have Pekah coming down against Israel, or against Judah, along with Syria, and Rezin, the king of Syria, and Ahaz is the king. Even though every way you add up Jotham's kingdom, he's still king at this point, but the dealing there in chapter 7 is with Ahaz. In fact, Isaiah makes the great prophecy, and we'll have a little bit of time on this on Sunday, to Ahaz in Isaiah chapter 7. What's the great prophecy? The virgin will conceive and have a child. And it's in reference to the attacks by Pekah. He said, before that child is old enough to be able to tell right from wrong, Pekah's going to be gone. Well, 2 or 3 years. It's not going to last long. All right? But that gives you an idea. Again, this is why it's difficult kind of keeping track of these, because there's nothing said in the text about that, except when you put all the pieces of the puzzle together, that you end up with, this is kind of what's going to happen here. Something has had to happen here where Ahaz has taken over, even though Jotham is still alive. So what do we know about Jotham? Well, we know a couple things. We know that he is still, he's a good king. There's that his heart was right with God. I don't know, we'll go that one yet. His heart is right with God. Look in 2 Kings, we're in 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 34, and LR, I'll let you read this one because it's okay.
Which one? Which verse?
2 Kings 15, 34.
And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. He did according to all that his father Uzzah had done. However, the high places had not been removed, and the people still sacrificed.
Pause. I just want verse 34.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah. And the reason I didn't want you to read that the other one is because it reads more like it's been interpreted through 1 Corinthians 15. And it's kind of projecting backwards. That's why I changed. And other versions read completely different. All right. So what we know, he's a good king. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord. He did according to all that his father Uzziah had done. Now keep a marker there and flip over to 2 Corinthians 27. 2 Corinthians 27 and verse 2 says something similar as well. And it says something I think is kind of funny. Verse 2 says, he did right in the sight of the Lord. This is 2 Chronicles. Did I say Corinthians?
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, I thought.
I was going to be really impressed.
2 Chronicles chapter 27, verse 2. Corinthians doesn't even have 27 chapters either, that you mentioned. Anyway, so he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Uzziah had done. So he's like his dad. His dad was good. His dad was very powerful. His dad was the one that had got setting up catapults and things on the, and was rebuilding the city and arming it and preparing it for war, because they knew Assyria was going to be coming, and Syria as well. And notice what else it says. However, he did not enter the temple of the Lord. I just read that and I'm like, okay, that's pretty interesting. Why do you think they said that? Because what did he just compare him to? Uzziah. But what did Uzziah do? He entered the temple. So Jotham was better than his dad. He didn't do something extremely insane like trying to take over the work of the priest.
Right? Maybe the little leprosy incident kind of scared him away.
It might have got his attention. I think it did get his attention, absolutely. All right. So he is there, and so he's a good king, and he does what is right. Now, then he's successful. Because of that, he's successful. There's a discussion, not a whole lot's going on, but during the days of Uzziah, they had really been able to conquer most of this territory here. They had taken down and defeated these cities in this territory. They had been able to assert power over these kingdoms. And here's where you get the overlap part of it. It talks about Ammon being beaten by Uzziah, but then it also talks about Jotham being the one that actually goes and conquers them and asserts the right to have tribute from them. Look in 2 Chronicles 27, verses 3 through 6. Well, let's say in verses 3, he talks about building the wall and the gates and building the fortresses. Verse 5 says, he fought also with the king of the Ammonites and prevailed over them, so that the Ammonites gave him during that year 100 talents of silver, 10,000 cores of wheat, and 10,000 of barley. The Ammonites also paid him this amount in the second and in the third year. So it seemed like that was a penalty. They had been supposed to, they were supposed to owe them and pay them a tribute. And because they had rebelled, they had to go out and defeat them and made them pay a penalty for 3 years of paying extra. But the interesting thought about that is that as you read that, you go back and you find that it says almost the same thing about Uzziah. So you see where the overlap takes place. It's Uzziah gets credit for it, even though really it's his son Jotham who did it. So, but it occurred while Uzziah was still considered king, while he was alive and had not yet died, even though he was in isolation because of his leprosy. And then verse 6 says, so Jotham became mighty because he ordered his ways before the Lord his God. Don't you wish you just read that about every king? Or every Christian, every church? All right, so that's, and then when you get to the end of verse 9, that's pretty much all that says about Jotham. So not a whole lot, other than he is good. Now, there's a problem though. Turn back to verse 2 here in 2 Chronicles 27. I left out the end of verse 2. Somebody read that. Very last sentence in verse 2. Say that again.
But the people still followed corrupt practices.
All right, the people still followed corrupt practices. What version is that?
I have the English Standard Version.
ESV, all right. New American Standard 1995 version says, but the people continued acting corruptly. So same thing. Same thing, different words. Why is there always a but? You know, it's just, everything's great, but it's not. There are problems. There are problems. So let me remind you what an old preacher said one time ago. He said he was talking to young preachers complaining about problems with people. And he says, well, do you know how to get rid of the problem?
Get rid of people.
Get rid of the people.
Get rid of the worst.
Yeah, and he said on top of that, he said, if you ever find a perfect church, leave before you mess it up. Yeah, so anyway, that there's a problem here. They're corrupted. And 2 Kings 15, verse 35, there's the other rinse, repeat, lather, rinse, repeat issue of them not putting away the high places. So even while he's king, he can't get rid of the high places, can't get the people to put them away completely. They just would not put them away. And so as a result, they were corrupted. And this is going to and this is going to cause problems. Go back actually to 2 Kings 15, and I want you to know something it says there in 2 Kings 15. Verse 37 tells you about what's going on, where the backwash of sin in other places is spilling over on them. Verse 37 says, in those days the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Aram, or Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. So even as he's building the nation and being strong and powerful, there's war and there are problems on the doorstep, on the horizon that they're facing. And that's what's coming to them. So, thoughts, comments so far about that? All right. Okay, go ahead.
No, it's fine.
All right, turn over to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah, interestingly enough, mentions Jotham one time. Even though it's, and that one time is in verse 1. It says, the vision of Isaiah the son of Amoz concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. And so he's writing his book and prophesying during the days of Jotham and Uzziah. But Jotham's never mentioned by name outside of this one verse. But it's thought that probably chapters 1 through 5 and 6 really are written about events during that are going on during the times of Jotham. And this is where it gets into, and I think this is that corruption that's going on in the city. Look in chapter 1 and beginning of verse 10, and we'll read down through verse 17. And let's read that. Matt, you want to read that for us? 10 through 17.
Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Listen to the instructions of God, you people of Gomorrah. The multitude of your sacrifices, what are they to me, said the Lord? I have more than enough of burnt offerings, of rams, and of the fat of fattened animals. I have no pleasure in the blood of bulls and lambs and goats. When you come to appear before me, who has asked this of you? This trampling of my courts. Stop burning meaningless offerings. Your incense is detestable to me. New moons, Sabbaths, and convocations, I cannot bear your worthless assemblies. Your new moon feasts and your appointed festivals, I hate with all my being. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands in prayer, I hide my eyes from you. Even when you offer many prayers, I am not listening. Your hands are full of blood. Wash and make yourselves clean. Take your evil deeds out of my sight. Stop doing wrong. Learn to do right. Seek justice. Defend the oppressed. Take up the cause of the fatherless. Plead the case of the widow.
Okay. I like that version. What version is that?
NIV.
NIV? Okay, I like the way they talked it and said that. So the first thing that he's dealing with is their corrupt worship. Now, and when he say corrupt worship, this he's describing things that would be part of their regular worship. These would be things that they were supposed to be doing. What was the problem with the things that they were supposed to be doing? All right, so hypocrisy would be a word that we could use for it, that they're going through the motions. This is something that complains, that is reasonable complaint sometimes about churches. You feel like you're just kind of going through the motions, and we're called to put, that it's from the heart, that we worship and serve God from the heart.
Doing things to the letter, but not in spirit.
All right, you're doing the things you're supposed to do, but not with the right attitude or the right spirit, okay? And that's what he's doing. So he deals with that. He says, I'm sick of it. He says, I'm sick of this. I mean, this is pretty strong language. Even though this late nation is going to last another 100 years before he says, I'm done with you. But anyway, so he says that. And then in verses 15 through 17, he kind of shifts to what else is going on outside worship that spills into and affects their worship. What's going on outside of worship?
Clearly they're guilty of some atrocities of some kind. Their hands are full of blood. They're committing some kind of evil inside of God.
Yeah, they're evil people. They're doing bad things. They're not right with God, and so they're conducting themselves in ways that are unacceptable to him, and then coming in and worshiping, acting like they hadn't done it. And that so that is a terrible thing that's going on there. And so he's telling them, you need to get right. He said, before you come in with the sacrifices, get clean. Cleanse your hearts. Cleanse, get rid of this evil. Then in verse, and not only get rid of the evil, but then what's the positive side of it in verse 17?
Learn to do good.
Learn to do good.
Seek justice.
Seek justice. Reprove the root. You know, stop the bad guys. Defend the orphan. Plead for the widow. So defend the defenseless. Care for and protect those people who need to be cared for and protected. Because that was one of the things, a constant complaint of God throughout the history, is that, and even in the days of Jesus, what did he complain about the Pharisees? What were they doing? They're using the law to do what?
Rob the widows.
Rob the widows and the orphans. Oh, your husband died. I'll loan you the money. Oh, okay. Well, you weren't supposed to loan him money. You know, I'm going to sell your child into slavery because you can't pay me back. They just were heartless and cruel. And this is mirrored in Micah chapter 6 and verse 8. Somebody turn over there and read that for us. And then also in Amos chapter 5. I can't read my handwriting here with glasses. 5 verse 24. Yeah, Micah 6, 8 and Amos 5, 24.
He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God.
We let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. All right.
So the first thing that anybody who wants to be a child of God, with that be considered part of the people of God, someone like Jotham, is seek to be right with God. Do what is right, not just in worship, but in the life that we live outside of it that brings into and has an effect. Because as Stephanie said earlier, sin doesn't just affect me or whoever commits it. It has an impact on everybody else. And so when God's kind of getting back to this we're done thing that we started out at the beginning, you know, we have to kind of always wonder, how long will God work with us if we rebel against him instead of doing what he says? Don't know. You know, it talks in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, it talks about churches where you have some churches, a couple of them that are really good, all the rest of them have some problems, and you have churches where God's ready to wipe them out or says he's going to remove their candlestick. There's faithful people there. They need to remain faithful. The church, the unfaithful need to repent. At some point, he's going to remove a candlestick. When that's going to be, I don't know. Not my call. But what do I need to do? Purify my robe.
Does it say remain faithful?
Remain faithful. Remain faithful. But God will eventually. Romans 11 and John 15 talk about how God will cast off faithless branches. When will he cast them off? I don't know. That's up to him. But we need to be concerned that he can and will. Revelation 2 and 3 talk about churches as well as individuals. And so we have to be very careful about what we participate in and what we do and seek God in worship and in our lives outside. It's a whole package. There can't be any kind of bifurcation where here's how I am at church, here's how I live my life out in the world. All right, we'll pick up with Ahaz. Read about it. Oh, by the way, if you want to read about Ahaz, read Isaiah. We read a lot about Ahaz and Isaiah.
Thank you.